by and large, on both sides of the aisle, this is a group of people who are here because they care about the communities that they serve, because they want to do the right thing. They're giving up time with their families, time with their other jobs, to be down here trying to make the state a better place. And it is hugely inspiring to watch all of the effort and time that people put into making good policy that will make the state a better place.
Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Roll on, Columbia, roll on. Your power is turning our darkness to dawn. So roll on.
Hello and welcome to Capital Ideas. This is where we sit down with members of the Democratic majority in the Washington State House of Representatives to give listeners an inside look at important aspects of how their citizen legislature works and who and what it's working for. We're speaking today with State Representative Jamie Peterson. Jamie represents Washington's 43rd Legislative District, which is about as urban as a district can get in Washington State. He's got the world-famous Pike Street Market, First Hill, a huge part of downtown Seattle, Capitol Hill, Green Lake, and Lake Union, the University of Washington campus, Fremont, Wallingford. In other words, he represents much of what people all over the world have in mind when they think of Seattle. A lawyer in his non-legislative career, Jamie was elected to the Washington State House of Representatives in 2006 and currently chairs the House Judiciary Committee. He also serves on the House Business and Financial Services Committee and the Budget Writing, General Government Appropriations, and Oversight Committee. Welcome, Jamie, and thanks for joining us today on Capital Ideas.
Thanks very much. Happy to be here.
In the introduction to every one of these podcasts, I mentioned that a goal is to help people understand how their legislature really works. It's really not as simple as how a bill becomes law in five easy steps, but in a sense, that's what a lot of citizens really do want to know. And it seems to me that some of the keywords in a topic like this would be compromise, adaptability, tenacity, wisdom, and then possibly more compromise. This topic is not just coincidental this week. The fact is you've got an unusual track record in terms of the legislature passing a high percentage of the bills that you propose. Some lawmakers, and these are effective, well-respected legislators, might introduce a few dozen bills during a session and only see one or two become law. Just looking at your list of sponsored bills, it seems that more often than not, a bill you sponsor will ultimately end up being signed by the governor. What is your secret?
Well, I think the first thing is that I'm pretty choosy about where I spend my time. So a lot more people come to me with ideas that they have for legislation than I end up dropping bills for. I think it's pretty unhelpful to our process to have a huge jumble of ideas thrown into the hopper without the sufficient thought put into them and work with stakeholders to make sure that there's a reasonable chance that they can get all the way through the process. So this last session, if you leave aside a couple of bills that I was asked to do by the Ways and Means Chair, I introduced 9 pieces of legislation and 8 of those were signed into law by the governor.
If you don't mind, I'd like to use one of your successful bills as an example today in this conversation. House Bill 1783, which you introduced in February of this year, had to do with houseboats, the kind of single-family floating home that Tom Hanks had in Sleepless in Seattle. What was your aim with that bill?
The 43rd District, aside from being exceptional in a lot of the ways that you mentioned to begin with, is also the home to a significant percentage of the houseboats in the state. In fact, I'd say that between the 43rd and the 36th, probably 95% of the houseboats are in those two districts, mostly on Lake Union, Portage Bay, that area, a few, I guess, on the Sound. The houseboat idea came to me from the Floating Homes Association. As the city of Seattle is working to implement a new shoreline master plan under the Shoreline Management Act, there is substantial concern among those constituents of mine who live on houseboats about the effect that those new regulations will have on their ability to remodel their houses, to keep up their houses, just to maintain them, and ultimately on the value of their houses, because if you can't remodel and maintain the houses, then they will decline in value. And so they came to believe that the best option for them was to bring a bill before the state legislature and try to provide some protection for their community. After checking in with my colleagues, I concluded that this was something that was both a good idea and politically possible to do. So I let the Floating Homes Association people know that I would be willing to be the prime sponsor.
Once you introduced this bill, once you dropped this bill, it was assigned to the committee for consideration.
And Dan, let me back you up a little bit before that, because I think one of the things that people may not understand is that before a bill gets introduced, it has to get drafted. And then after getting drafted, we have what's called a blue sheet. That's the opportunity for other legislators to become co-sponsors. One of the things that I try to do regularly, I think it's true of every bill that I introduce this session, is to have a bipartisan group of sponsors. And so the initial work of persuasion on a bill is to go around to legislators, particularly on the committees that are likely to be hearing the bill, and get them to support the bill, agree to be co-sponsors. So I had a number of Republican co-sponsors for the legislation, and most of the members of the local government committee signed up and convinced before the bill was ever introduced. I think that's an important part of the process that's somewhat invisible to people on the outside.
And let me ask you a question about that process. Let's say you go to a particular legislator, regardless of whether it's a Democrat or a Republican, and they're on the committee that's going to be looking at your bill. Will he or she sign on as a co-sponsor, even though maybe they know that there's something about that bill that doesn't sit well with them? Will they sign on to something that they're 80% in favor of, with the hope that at some point they're going to tweak it a little bit?
I'd say that there are 147 different answers to that question, that being the number of legislators in the legislature. A lot of the work that we do here is done completely on trust. If I take a bill to someone, there's a relationship usually between me and that person, and a sense that if I'm bringing it to them, I'm not out to get them or likely to hang them out by insisting on something unreasonable in the bill. And so I'd say that the most common pattern is that if someone likes you, trusts you, doesn't see a huge philosophical objection in what you're trying to do, that if you've taken the time to go and ask them and try to persuade them, they're likely to sign on as a co-sponsor of the bill. But there are absolutely people who will not sign on to a bill initially if there's any piece of it that they're not supportive of. They may well tell you, look, I'm happy to vote for it eventually if this can get worked out, but this is a significant problem for me. On the flip side of that, of course, is that bills can get amended during our process almost out of recognizable form. And so in some ways, when you co-sponsor a piece of legislation, you are writing a blank check to the prime sponsor of that bill and hoping that they'll not mistreat you during the course of the legislation's life, because any amendment that's within the title and scope of the bill is potentially something that your name will be associated with forever. That's why it's a complicated subject to determine whether you're going to sign on to something, and not always about what the words are that are in there at the time that you read the bill initially.
Well, this brings us to my next question, which is, the bill goes initially to this committee where it is amended. So it comes out somewhat different than it went into that committee. Do you recall what the amendment was that they made?
The Floating Homes folks were out for a really fundamental change in the Shorelines Management Act, requiring the state, in exercising its regulatory authority, to promote houseboats. Not just to tolerate them, but actively to make it easier for houseboats to exist. On the other hand, they were pretty guarded in the way that they went about doing that, so they limited the applicability of the bill only to the city of Seattle and only to houseboats that were in existence prior to January 1st, 2011. The committee, which is composed largely of people from outside of Seattle, heard testimony and I think had concerns about houseboats in other areas of the state. And so the big amendment from House Local Government and Housing was to broaden the reach of the bill so that it affected all houseboats in the state and not only houseboats in the city of Seattle.
All right. They amend it. They recommend that it go to the Rules Committee and on to the full House. It's called a do pass recommendation. About a month after you introduced the bill, it was voted on by the full House. that amended version passed. The impression a lot of people have is that all Democrats support all bills sponsored by Democrats and all Republicans don't, and vice versa. But the House vote, like the earlier committee vote, didn't follow that stereotype.
You know, I'd say the most common pattern for bills by number is that they would pass out nearly unanimously from the House. I'd say if we passed 300 bills in a session, it's likely that 200 or more of them would be nearly unanimous. The attention from the press and from the public tends to come on the really controversial bills, which is a small number of bills that end up passing by relatively narrow margins. This bill was unusual in that the vote was actually relatively close coming out of the House the first time, but among the yeses were Republicans and Democrats, and among the noes were Republicans and Democrats. The interesting thing, I think, is that there were Republicans who voted against the bill, I think largely based on a misunderstanding about the bill as it turned out afterwards. They thought that it was already the case that houseboats were water-dependent uses, and so this was unnecessary. You know, nevertheless, there were a number of Republicans who voted for the bill. On our side, there were a number of people who consider themselves strong environmental advocates who were concerned about the environmental effects of houseboats or more houseboats. So the green environmentalist position was also against the bill in the form that it had passed out of the committee. My position, and I think the position of the Floating Homes Association, was that they would ultimately be satisfied with quite a bit less in the bill than what they had asked for, but it was helpful for the process for them to have a signal that the House was willing to pass it in a very strong form. So that's why we didn't go to the end position earlier in the negotiations.
Having been okayed by the House now, your amended bill, which is now called Substitute House Bill 1783, heads for the Senate. At that point, it's assigned to the Committee on Natural Resources and Marine Waters. They amend it again. Then it moves on to consideration by the full Senate, and they decide they don't like the amendment that their own committee placed on this bill. So they reject that amended version and okay a differently amended version instead. This time, out of 49 senators, 47 of them vote for the bill. When something like that happens, do you know ahead of time? Are you consulting actively with various senators, with the chair of the committee, with people that you think might be for it, might be against it? What kind of a process goes on there like?
For House bills moving through the process, the Senate is like the fish ladder. It becomes very difficult because the House passes more bills than the Senate is typically able to process in the second half of the session. That's one of the reasons that, in my view, it's important to be choosy about which bills and how many you want to run during a particular session, because ultimately you're going to have the ability as a House member only to ask for a certain number of bills to be moved out of the Rules Committee to be voted on the floor, and in any given committee even to be considered by that committee, because lots of bills die at each of those stages in the process. So as soon as the bill passed out of the House, and probably even before that, I was in contact with Senator Kevin Ranker, who is the chair of that committee, and was trying to work with him and with the ranking member over there to anticipate objections to move the bill through the committee. I had a wonderful letter from a constituent of mine named Lillian, who was age 4.5, as she wrote on her letter, talking about how much she liked living on a houseboat and please pass House Bill 1783. Which was a great hit in my short testimony before the Senate committee. In the background, negotiations, without me being mostly a part of it, other than being updated from time to time, were ongoing among the City of Seattle, the Floating Homes Association, and the Department of Ecology. And I think folks from the governor's office, probably committee staff on both sides, trying to work out an acceptable compromise. The version of the bill passed out of the Senate committee originally was the state of negotiations at that time. The version that ultimately presented itself on the Senate floor was a fully worked out bill. At that time, it's sort of like a litigation settlement. Both sides had assessed their risk of having nothing pass, or on the other hand, of having something pass that they really didn't like. And so they had come to compromise language about houseboats. And ultimately, the change to the Shoreline Management Act did not get made. But pretty strong language was included in the bill that said existing floating homes were a preferred non-conforming use and that the state and local governments needed to do what they could to protect them and not unduly interfere with them. That made my constituents very happy, and it was also language that the environmental regulatory authorities could live with. And I think the fact that we got to largely a consensus on that is reflected in the final votes, both in the House and then when the bill came, or in the Senate, and then when the bill came back to the House at the end of session for concurrence.
So your bill, which has now been amended three times, comes back to the House for a final vote. Unlike the first time when the vote was 52 yes, 40 no, with D's and R's in both columns, this time all the Democrats that had originally voted no got behind the bill, and it passed 65 to 32, with all the no votes coming from Republicans. But the Republicans also gave quite a few yes votes to the bill, so it was still a very bipartisan bill. This was a success story. It was amended several times. You seem to be happy with the way the bill turned out. This is not a situation where you introduced a bill, it was amended three times, and by the time you got to the point where it heads for the governor's desk, you don't even recognize it or necessarily even support the finished version, which I suppose can happen.
In theory, that can happen. As a practical matter, it does not typically happen. The prime sponsor and the committee chair each continue to have a lot of influence through the process on bills. And that's partly because so many bills die just because they run out of steam. There isn't somebody really pushing for them. The prime sponsor can always, until the very end, can say, look, I don't want that bill to be voted on. I don't support it anymore. I don't like the way that it's been amended. It's unlikely that a bill would be signed into law by the governor that you really don't like, although you may be not entirely satisfied with the way that it's amended through the process.
Well, that's another question, maybe a final question, which is, how do you know when it's time to just let something die that has some momentum, but you don't like the momentum that you're seeing? How do you know when to walk away from a bill and just say, we'll try again next year, maybe?
I think there are a lot of different points of view, probably, again, 147 of them, about that question. There are some people who believe very strongly that passing a half measure is really terrible because it will create the impression that action has been taken and there's not a need to revisit a particular issue for several years. There are other people who view incremental progress as the way that just about everything successful happens in this place, that the rough edges get sanded off of almost every proposal. And so it's much better to make a little bit of progress and just keep pushing the rock uphill session after session. And then that's how you get to the desired end result. I don't know that there's a right answer and a wrong answer to that question. It may depend on the issue. It may depend on how much energy you have for a particular issue. It probably depends as well on who the stakeholders are. One misimpression that people may have outside of Olympia is that we have, as legislators, all the control over how things move. The reality is that most successful bills have people outside of Olympia who care about them, who will call their elected officials to come down to testify about the bills, who want them to happen. And so a lot of the question about whether a particular bill has been amended too far has to do with how the stakeholders feel about it. Is it still worth it to pursue that bill? I had another bill this year that had to do with the medical discipline process and transparency in that process. And in that case, there were a few individual constituents who had pretty difficult experiences with the Medical Quality Assurance Commission and what they felt like was bad treatment in terms of transparency, who really wanted something to happen. They had some pretty specific ideas originally in the process, and a lot of those got whittled away as the process worked itself out. Those were people who wanted some progress, and ultimately they were very happy that something happened.
We're about out of time here today. I know you need to get on the road. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we wrap up today?
The only thing that I'd say is that when I was first thinking about running, one of the things that some colleagues at my law firm told me was that it would be a extremely frustrating experience that they warned me against because serving, that is, not running, because I would be dealing with a lot of incompetent people down here. And I have to say that that has absolutely not been my experience. You know, as with any group of 150 people, roughly, you're probably going to find some with whom you don't agree a lot, and, you know, some who are less competent or engaged than you would like. But by and large, on both sides of the aisle, this is a group of people who are here because they care about the communities that they serve, because they want to do the right thing. They are giving up time with their families, time with their other jobs, to be down here trying to make the state a better place. And it is hugely inspiring to watch all of the effort and time that people put into making good policy that will make the state a better place. So it's been a great experience. I'm really proud of how open our government is and how accessible it is. And I just hope that people will take the time to get more involved in it, to look more closely at what we're doing down here, take advantages of the opportunities that we have for them to do so, whether that's writing to legislators or attending committee hearings and testifying or watching the progress of bills. It really is available now with the advent of the internet in a way that I don't think it was for previous generations.
Thank you, Jamie.
Thank you.
It's been great.
Thank you very much.
That's today's program. Subscribe to this podcast now and spend a few minutes a week with Capital Ideas. After all, this is your state government, and the more you know about how it works, the better it can work for you. For State Representative Jamie Peterson and the Washington State House Democrats, I'm Dan Frizzell. Thank you for listening.